Welcome to the Drafting Table Podcast, hosted by Dominion Due Diligence Group. Today, we pick back up on the 2020 Map Guide webinar follow-ups, and we're going to be discussing Chapter 9. We've split Chapter 9, the environmental section, into it's going to either be three or four segments because there's so much to cover. A lot of small changes, but a lot of small changes that could potentially have large impacts to your property or your project timeline. Today, I have Hannah Pearl with me, who is going to be explaining some of the changes associated with the HEROES and NEPA processing. A little bit about Hannah before we get started. She's been with D3G for nearly 8 years now and is currently our NEPA compliance manager. However, she wears a lot more hats than just NEPA. Typically, her responsibilities include ensuring that D3G environmental reviews go as smooth as possible. So that's your Part 50 and Part 58 reviews. She's overseeing as much of that process associated with NEPA compliance and the HEROES submissions. Prior to her time at D3G, she worked as a civil engineer, and here she also oversees our 8-step for flood and wetland concerns. So if you've had a new construction project recently in the Southeast, you have probably worked with Hannah at some point. She's also an environmental professional and a nationally recognized certified floodplain manager, and also a fellow Virginia Tech Hokie like me. So Hannah, thanks for taking some time to join us, and how are you doing today?
Good morning. Thanks. I'm doing great and appreciate you having me.
Of course. Yeah, you're the perfect person to have on for this conversation because it's what you deal with, you know, professionally, and it's also something you've been dealing with for quite a while for us and prior to your time here at D3G. So I'm going to cut right to it. Today we're going to talk about changes in perspective for us, your due diligence provider, changes for the lender, what, you know, the lender responsibilities are going to be, and new HUD responsibilities, because some of the work that we've done in the past is now shifted to be a HUD responsibility. So first up, let's talk about SHPO. Hannah, that's one that's always a little bit difficult that could potentially become a little more difficult. Could you explain a few of those changes that have come out with the 2020 Map Guide?
Sure. Really, the big change with respect to SHPO and historic preservation in general is that HUD finally gave some really clear guidance, and is now for projects involving demolition of buildings over 45 years old or for projects with new construction within or adjacent to a historic district, and also substantial ground disturbing activities or exterior rehabilitations for older properties, an actual qualified historic preservation professional must evaluate the project and prepare SHPO submission materials. So there's an upside and a downside to this. On the downside, we'll be seeing an uptick in the need for studies by these historic preservation specialists, particularly for architectural surveys. A lot of the HUD projects that we deal with are very old properties, and we can definitely get into some timing issues if on the very back end, all of a sudden, we're finding out that a property has historic value and something additional needs to be done. On the upside, however, again, since HUD removed some of the ambiguity surrounding this topic, finally giving this very clear-cut guidance around what they want, it's something that can be identified early on now, which is especially important for certain states that require the correspondence to come from HUD directly. We now know exactly what HUD is going to require for their submission to the SHPO in cases like this, so we can advise lenders up front and ensure that HUD really has everything that they need, which will help to avoid those back-end timing delays.
Yeah, that's really good that you point that out, especially mentioning the back-end timing delays, because this is going to impact a lot of properties. I mean, when you talk about
absolutely
the specifics of buildings over 45 years old, that's not that old. I mean, it's considered potentially in a historic district, but I mean, it's not like we're talking about properties from the early 1900s here. This is going to impact a lot of any urban sub rehabs.
Absolutely.
Yep. So that's going to be something that we're going to have to prepare for, and your developer is going to need to prepare for as well. And we have so much experience dealing with each state and their requirements that we do have a good head start on the process. But now that HUD is going to be more involved, we also, you know, we know that HUD, they're historically not known for being the fastest moving ship on the sea. Do you expect that there could be some back-end delays just given the volume that HUD's dealing with right now?
Potentially. But again, that's why it's so important that we get these kinds of studies engaged as early as possible. You know, again, with it being much more clear now on HUD's side in terms of defining it to that very, you know, restrictive 45 years old or older. They're going to want some additional studies. They're going to want this project to be looked at by, you know, a qualified historic preservation specialist. If we leave all that to the end, you know, basic architectural and archaeological studies, they involve a great deal of research, plus field work, the extent of which is really determined by the scope of the study and the size of the area being studied. So generally, these studies take around 4 to 5 weeks, depending on consultant availability, and then they also need to be submitted to the SHPO for approval. So the earlier that borrowers can get that process going, the better. You know, I've definitely seen borrowers push this off, thinking that, you know, oh, well, we can deal with it later. We can deal with it later. Well, if your project finally gets submitted to HUD and then HUD comes back, you have nothing from the SHPO and they're looking at this older property saying, we need this survey. Well, now you're already an additional 4 to 5 weeks further down the road than you needed to be. So really identifying these right up front and getting that work done as early as possible so that what goes to HUD is this nice, neat package of everything that they need so they can just check the box and move on to the next item is really going to help to avoid those ending delays.
It's a really great point because you think about SHPO has standardized processing times. So if you submit your package to SHPO, it takes them 30, maybe 45 days right now, just based on volume and issues with COVID and staffing. Mm-hmm. To find out, you need some sort of additional study, whether it's an architectural review or an archaeological dig or some form of additional report to satisfy SHPO. So you've lost 30 days waiting to hear from SHPO. Then you have maybe 4 to 5 weeks for your report. That goes back to SHPO. And typically they do respond faster than 30 to 45 days on follow-up responses, but there's no guarantee there. So you are looking at the potential of losing a few months if you're not prepared from the beginning to deal with these sort of kind of checklist item issues from HUD, but it's so nice that they finally outlined exactly what type of property, what classification of property they're going to expect this sort of review for. And I know you did mention it, but you mentioned it. I want to mention it again, is these need to be prepared by a professional. And many states have a list of approved firms, but you can't just have any old Joe Schmo environmental firm take a quick look and call it a day. Is that correct?
That's correct. They actually have to be approved by the Secretary of the Interior. So they have to have very specific credentials in order to be considered qualified to conduct these particular types of studies.
Yeah, that's important because, you know, as development continues to rise, as development in urban areas picks back up, these consultants will be busy. So that's just something else to consider. So I think that's a really good summary of the changes with SHPO, which are some of the bigger changes from Chapter 9. We're going to move on to, you know, a similar process with TIPO, with tribal correspondence. So historically, over the past few years at least, that has been the sole responsibility of HUD. Is that correct?
Yeah. Essentially, HUD has always technically handled the TIPO consultations, as third parties are not allowed to consult with the tribal officers. The real difference in the new map guide now is that HUD made it clear that they want third-party consultants to identify each particular tribe to be notified and to prepare the letters on their behalf. So it basically takes an additional item off their plate. So more work for us, less work for HUD. But ultimately, this is actually a good thing for lenders because the more that we as the consultants can do to provide HUD with all the documentation that they need, so it's less for somebody over there to figure out how to compile a package or something like that, it's going to save time. So this is really, it's additional work for us, but it's really a good change for the lenders.
Yeah, but nonetheless, you know, anytime a map guide comes out, more work does seem to be steered our way. And this is this is one of those cases where in some regions, there may only be, you know, one or two TIPO groups or offices, tribes that need to be contacted. And in some cases, there could be, you know, I'm sure you've seen cases with 4 to 6 different tribes that need to be contacted.
And I actually just worked on a project yesterday where there are 13 tribes that need to be contacted. So yeah, it can vary.
Wow. And I would imagine that the type of the type of request and the format of that request can change based on the tribal requirements as well.
It's actually pretty standardized for each of the tribes. Basically, we just need to provide them with a letter that will provide HUD with a letter that they can put their letterhead on that describes the project and gives the tribes a specific enough level of detail regarding what work is involved and everything. So
that's good to know. So the takeaway here is making sure that you're working with an environmental, you know, report provider like us at D3G that's very familiar with this process, with, you know, knowing that, hey, this region actually has 13 tribes that we need to contact, not two or three. Because if you if you were to leave off one of those tribes or a couple of those tribes, you submit your paperwork to HUD. HUD trusts us that we did our research accordingly. They send off all the correspondence. It all comes back, and then they're getting ready to approve that HEROES review, and then someone catches, well, we left off a couple of tribes. Then you're potentially looking at another delay there. So it's becoming more important than ever that your third-party environmental providers are well-versed in everything to do with NEPA. So, Hannah, it is so great to have you on staff here because you're exactly that. So we're going to move on to one of the next big changes, something else that you've probably dealt with and didn't like dealing with, and that's FEMA changes. Specifically, I would like to talk with you about the base flood elevation change and what it means from moving from 12 inches to 2 feet base flood elevation. And just what does that even mean? Because, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and even I get confused sometimes with how that's calculated and what it means.
Sure. Well, the base flood elevation, or BFE, is the approximate elevation to which floodwaters are estimated to reach during a 100-year flooding event. So, for example, if a FEMA map indicates a BFE of 10 feet, they expect surface waters to reach an elevation of approximately 10 feet above sea level during a major flooding event. That's just, you know, basically what the BFE refers to. Now, probably the biggest floodplain management change between the 2016 map guide and the 2020 map guide is that the old guide required that new structures be constructed a minimum of 1 foot or 12 inches above the base flood elevation, while the new guide requires that they be constructed a minimum of 2 feet above the base flood elevation. This provides, you know, kind of an additional factor of safety against flooding. So this is really something that developers and their engineers will really need to be aware of as they design proposed HUD developments in order to make sure their plans are HUD compliant. Because previously, you know, if your base flood elevation was 10 and you constructed your structures at 11 feet, then you were good. Now those structures are going to need to be constructed at 12 feet in order to meet the new requirements of the new map guide. Now, HUD also made a change to how they look at existing structures with respect to the BFE. Previously, they allowed kind of a 12-inch buffer for existing structures such that if your lowest floor elevations and lowest adjacent grade elevations were no greater than 12 inches below the BFE, the project was deemed acceptable from a floodplain management standpoint. However, the new map guide remove that buffer, as HUD now wants to see existing structures with those elevations at or above the BFE. So now this is an automatic deal breaker for existing structures. So it's not as if every refinance deal that comes our way, if it doesn't meet this, it's not an automatic HUD's going to say no kind of thing. But it does mean that HUD's going to look at those projects that don't meet this criteria for existing structures. They're going to look at those with additional scrutiny and may require some sort of mitigation measures to be implemented. So it's definitely something to be aware of, that they've gotten rid of that little buffer that people used to kind of rely on for existing structures. So that's unfortunate, but it is a very important change to be aware of with the new map guide.
Especially given the volume of refinances that we're seeing right now. And especially, absolutely, you know, the FEMA maps are changing. We'll talk a little bit about more some of those changes here in a second. But, you know, the two big takeaways here is if you're doing a new construction project and you have some sort of flood concern on your site, you're either going to have to change your building location or you're going to have to increase the elevation of that building. Both sound easy on paper, but when you hand that to an architect and an engineer and you're getting cost, This is just another one of those items that, you know, in the name of safety and protection, it is an additional expense to the process. If you're thinking about, you know, another foot of whether it's concrete blocks or anything else structurally, you know, this is going to impact your cost for the project. And if you're doing a refinance, I mean, this is really something to pay attention to, because that we see it every week. There's a property that has some sort of refinance that has some sort of question mark associated with where this property falls compared to the flood zone. So again, great to point that out, because it is a change that will impact both D4 and your Fs. Another one of those changes associated with FEMA, though, that I alluded to was the limois. And it's a fun word to say, but maybe not a fun thing to deal with. Can you explain, to our audience what it is and what it means for development?
Sure. We're seeing it on newer mapping projects within coastal areas where FEMA has designated an area known as the limit of moderate wave action, or limois. This basically marks the separation between the coastal high hazard area and the standard 100-year flood zone. So whereas coastal high hazard areas feature approximate wave heights of greater than 3 feet, the limois refers to the area where wave heights are expected to reach between 1.5 and 3 feet. So as you can imagine, this certainly represents a risk to property and lives, and HUD is not a fan of projects that have this designation on site. To that end, with the new map guide, they finally addressed this, because previously you really didn't see the limois on FEMA maps until the last few years. But per the new map guide, new development within a limois is prohibited. So they look at it kind of the same as coastal high hazard areas, that they're not going to allow new development within a limois. And they kind of quote-unquote actively discourage providing mortgage insurance for existing developments with an on-site limois. So really, to all lenders, you know, I strongly advise that you avoid projects with an on-site limois. It can definitely trip you up and completely destroy the ability to get HUD financing.
Yeah, it seems like the ocean side just became ocean view. You're not going to be able to newly construct property as, you know, as close to some of these bay or the Gulf or the ocean. It's just the buffer is now even greater than it was before for your separation from.
Absolutely. And a lot of that is due to all of the flooding events, the hurricanes and stuff. You know, there's been a lot of property damage. There have been lives lost. HUD is taking a more stringent approach to it, just as FEMA is. So that's kind of what is driving all of this, that you're seeing these more restrictive designations.
Yeah, and again, I'm really glad that HUD was clear in their outline with what to expect if you have this on your property, if you're trying to develop in this area. And they didn't even really crack the door for you. They said, no, we're not going to allow this. It's discouraged. So that's great whenever there's not a lot of gray area with these restrictions for development, because it's a developer's nature to kind of push the limits in a lot of ways, and they're not going to be able to do that here with through HUD financing, which it's nice when it's clear, especially on our end, because we're often painted as the bad guy that's bringing the bad news. But it's nice when we have something that's very clearly defined in the map guide for properties that do have the limois. Next up, let's transition a little bit to fish and wildlife, and that's something that we've been just on our own dealing with a lot more lately than in the past. And we're expecting some changes there as well that will impact processing time, some lender responsibilities, definitely some HUD responsibilities. So could you talk us through the changes for fish and wildlife?
Sure. Per the new map guide, HUD no longer wants third-party consultants to handle the determinations and consultations with the Fish and Wildlife Service. They, of course, still want us to do all of the legwork and provide them with all of the appropriate documentation, but they're now saying that all the determinations of effect have to actually come from HUD. The reason that this may become an issue is, of course, that HUD doesn't intend to submit any consultations for which they are responsible, you know, such as tribal consultations, until after an application has been submitted and they've started to review the environmental reporting and all of that, you know. So it's not something that they're doing up front in the early days of working through a project. You know, this is, you've already submitted your firm app, they're halfway through their review, and now it's when they're sending off a consultation package. So if at that time it turns out that Fish and Wildlife wants a biological survey or something of that nature performed by a local consultant, I mean, that can definitely impact your timeline. And what further complicates things is that many species surveys can only be conducted during certain times of the year. So you could end up with a significant hit to your timeline, as well as potential complications with HUD processing times, all because HUD doesn't want to allow for us to do the consultation up front and identify the possible need for any of these studies, which is a very unfortunate change. However, you know, we at Duke RE-G, we're kind of taking a creative approach to how we're going to handle this. For the time being, we've started, you know, submitting documentation to the Fish and Wildlife Service requesting simply technical assistance on a project so that we can get feedback from them on whether or not they feel that biological studies or things of that nature would be required, so that at least we can identify that upfront and communicate that to our clients so that they know this is what needs to happen, this is what HUD is ultimately going to require, and we can get things started a lot earlier in the process. And then once we have everything wrapped up, we just put together the package and deliver it to HUD as, here you go, you make your final determination and send in your consultation. But at least that way, it gives us a little bit more flexibility in identifying the need for any of these, because the last thing we want is for you to be like ready to close on a deal and then HUD says they need a biological survey and the survey for that species can't be done for the next 6 months. I mean, where does that fit in with an appropriate timeline? You know, it just kind of kills things. So we're trying to do everything on our end that we can to identify the need for any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's great. And that's another one of those things that just comes from our experience with development in certain regions of the country. But it's a really great point that, you know, so I work with our clients primarily all day, every day. And when I first saw this, selfishly, I said, wow, you know, I don't have to deliver the bad news anymore that there's going to be the need for a biological study for, you know, eastern indigo snakes or certain bats or the gopher tortoise or whatever else may be on potentially in your property area.
And I thought, yeah, look how much you've learned about endangered species just talking to me all the time.
No kidding. So, if selfishly I said, well, I'm not going to have to deliver that piece of bad news, so that's a win for me. But at the end of the day, you know, it is a little concerning just knowing that HUD's timeline to submit these documents to Fish and Wildlife. I mean, there's a lot of information that goes into preparing that letter, that correspondence. And again, that's still, a lot of that's still going to fall on us, but there's a lot of technical information there as well.
There's a tremendous amount of technical information and detail that goes into it. And yeah, I mean, I would say that lenders can expect to see an uptick in requests for biological surveys simply because we don't want to put them in that position where it's down at the nth hour and all of a sudden a survey needs to be done and it can't be done for the next 6 months. You know, it's better to get that stuff up front, make sure that we have solid documentation for everything that HUD is going to need, because the average HUD reviewer doesn't have a lot of experience with this particular topic. So unless it's very clear cut to them, you know, with proper documentation, they're going to err on the side of caution and say, I need more. So when we can identify the need up front and get that work going and make sure that we get HUD everything that they need, it's just going to help the whole process go much smoother and avoid those back end timing delays.
Yeah, we're going to do everything we can to help you avoid that nightmare situation where you have to put your project on hold for 6 months to wait for one particular study when you already have contractors lined up ready to go. You have plans in with the municipality, you have roads incoming, you have utilities incoming, and then everything has to hit pause. So we're going to do everything we can to help you avoid that. We also try to keep these podcasts moving pretty quickly and kind of cover a lot in a short amount of time. So I'm going to touch on a couple more things and then we're going to wrap up. One thing that I wanted to mention that I've been seeing specifically over the last few weeks to really the last couple of months since the map guide was released is I've seen HUD asking for additional noise studies on refinances. They kind of tie that to marketability. They tie it to structural concerns in some cases. I've seen more requests for vibration analysis in the last 2 weeks than I've seen in the last 10 years. So expect that as it's kind of a NEPA-related item. Expect to potentially see an additional evaluation on 223Fs for potential noise concerns. So if you're right next to the railroad tracks, you're underneath the flight path of a large airport, you have a military base nearby, or you're sitting right next to the highway, HUD may start asking you more questions than they have in the past. So again, we're going to kind of wrap this up. We've touched on a lot today, from SHPO, TIPO, some FEMA changes, touched on noise. And all of these things are things that we just wanted to bring to your attention. You know, we're not screaming from the rooftops that, you know, the world's coming to an end or that HUD financing is no longer a viable option. We just want you to be prepared that as things change, your process is going to have to change and your expectations that you set with your development group is going to have to change. Not necessarily change in a bad way, but just change in form of preparation. And like I've said many times before, it really all stems back to making sure you build a great team around yourself that has the experience and the knowledge of what HUD is going to expect for your particular application. So I wanted to thank Hannah again for her time, for joining us today, for joining the webinar, and providing tons of notes for our company to use to help better serve you. Again, this was part one of probably, I'm not sure if it'll be three or four parts, because we have a lot to cover with environmental. The next one we're going to cover is probably going to discuss site aggregation, pipelines, and separation, distance separation calculations. We're waiting to hear a few things on that, but I plan to record that podcast within the next week and get it out to you. So thanks for taking time to join us. And as always, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out to us. Thank you.